Welcome to the Climate Hour. I'm Bob Grove, your host. Tonight's topic is sustainable living, how we as individuals can make simple changes in our lives to reduce our carbon footprint and help reverse global warming. We're joined tonight by several members of the Regional Climate Council, Philip Francica of Renewable Missouri. Hi, Philip.
Hey, happy to be here.
Ken Reed, he's the new president of the Heartland Renewable Energy Society. Hi, Ken.
Hello.
Mark Garwin, he's the Metro Farms and Food Systems Programmer with Cultivate KC. Hi, Mark.
Good afternoon.
Stan Slaughter, he's with Missouri Organic Recycling. And Eileen Bobowski, who's the Executive Director of the Sewing Lab. Before we get started, let me provide some context. So we're here to talk about reducing our personal carbon footprint. Carbon footprint is another way of saying reducing greenhouse gas emissions. Greenhouse gases are those atmospheric gases that trap heat and cause global warming. Global warming is the long-term rise in the average of the Earth's surface temperature, which in turn causes climate change. Climate change is changes in the Earth's climate systems that result in new weather patterns, and new weather patterns lead to natural disasters. So let me see if I can string those concepts together into a simple sentence. Increasing greenhouse gases causes global warming, which leads to climate change that causes weather disasters. So the climate crisis is really about the weather disasters, the droughts, floods, fires, hurricanes. What, a couple of months ago we had a derecho. I've never even heard of that before. It's like an inland hurricane. This is a 150 mile per hour wind sweeping through Nebraska, Iowa, Wisconsin. Last year, we saw a shift in the Arctic jet stream that caused Chicago to hit record low temperatures in the negative 20, negative 30s, wind chills down into the negative 50s. These are weather disasters that are costing us billions of dollars in lives and property damage. And the way we stop them, at least in theory, is really quite simple. We just reduce the greenhouse gases in our atmosphere. The Environmental Protection Agency has this great pie chart that summarizes global greenhouse gas emissions by sector. I have that in front of us here. You can see it breaks it down into what is really four large sectors, and each of us as individuals can address our emissions in these sectors. The biggest is electricity and heat production in our power plants. There's a couple small pie charts. If you see this on the EPA's website, they have other energy, which is actually the greenhouse gas emissions that come from mining fossil fuels and shipping them to the power plants. So for practical purposes, we can lump that one in with electricity and heat production. And there's also a small pie slice that's called buildings. And these are buildings that are generating their own heat and power. For instance, your home, if you have a gas furnace, you're burning fossil fuels to heat your home. So that building sector can also be dropped in with electricity and heat production. So if we look at that, those pie chart slices combined, we're actually looking at 41% of all greenhouse gas emissions coming from the electricity and heat production. The next big pie chart is agricultural and forestry, which represents 24% of our emissions. Transportation is 14% of our emissions, and industry is 21% of our emissions. So we're going to go through those one by one today and discuss how we as individuals can address our greenhouse gas emissions within each sector. So let's start with the energy sector, and I refer this to sustainable energy. The big thing here is renewable energy, moving away from burning things like fossil fuels and going to the renewable things. Philip, why don't you start? You're with Renew Missouri. I know you guys are really focused on wind and solar.
I mean, as residents of Kansas City or just in the state of Missouri, there are a lot of options available to you. Evergy currently has solar rebates for homeowners, business owners that are pretty generous. So I would encourage that if you're a Missourian to take advantage of it. Out in the eastern side of the state with Ameren, Missouri, they also have some solar rebates. They're going up a little faster or going away faster. They're being taken advantage of by customers and they're installing solar at a higher rate than we are here around Evergy. So we still have a lot available to folks out here. And as for when we're seeing more and more projects go up, but there really isn't an option for individuals to get access to it as well as solar right now on a distributed level. And then if you're looking at, if you're a renter, You're not a homeowner if you're not able to put solar up on your property. Evergy also has a solar subscription program that is 83% subscribed. Once that gets to 90%, they'll start building it, and that's going to be a 5-megawatt system. And one thing that we always talk about in climate change and issues of relocation are low-income communities and communities of color. And we really see community solar as a way to level the playing field and bring access to renewables to everyone. So we're really, really pushing to hope we can get this solar program built and see more of that here in Kansas City.
I think the resources coming from public utilities are great and important. I don't think we have to wait. You know, those of us that are homeowners in our personal lives, we can start transitioning to electricity now, even if we're still getting electricity from our fossil fuel plants. You know, if we start moving to electricity now, as the public utilities come on board, we're already set up to take advantage of that. For instance, in your home, if you have a gas-powered furnace, you might consider investing in a heat pump, or ductless mini splits are actually the way to go. I mean, if you're not familiar with that, just go on your search engine and look for ductless mini splits. They've been used in Europe for over 40 years. And this is a ductless system, so it's kind of like a heat pump, but you're actually putting units in each room that heat and cool the room without loss through the heat ducts. And that gives you zones that you can heat and cool different rooms separately. So, I mean, some rooms cooler, some rooms hotter. A lot of them have remote thermostats, and some of them even have motion sensing. So as you go into a room, it can warm up that room very quick. So that's a solution you can put in your new home, obviously very effective because you don't have to pay for ducts. But even in terms of retrofitting older homes, these are systems that are very cost effective and have very low greenhouse gas emissions. You can look at that. Look at your water usage. If you're using a gas-powered water heater, there are electric on-demand water heaters that are extremely efficient and move you from fossil fuel to electricity. The advantages, of course, is that you get instant hot water. You don't have to wait to drain all that cold water out of that copper pipe before your shower gets warm. You also don't have to waste the heat of heating all those pipes. It just heats the water as it reaches the faucet. So those are very cost-effective. Another place we burn fossil fuels in our home is in our kitchen, our gas ranges. And, you know, I mean, I'm a chef, so we all love gas cooking, the instant control. And the traditional electric coil, electric ranges, just hard to cook with, you know, they're hard. The new electric induction systems are amazing, and a lot of chefs are moving to these. The induction system gives you the temperature control of a gas range without burning a fossil fuel. It's actually a magnet induction system that heats the iron in your pan or skillet instantly, and it doesn't radiate any excess heat. As a chef, I really love these. So yeah, I'd encourage everybody to look at that. And what else? I mean, heating, cooling, cooking.
Do you have any experience using pot skirts or hay box cookers?
I do not. Tell us about that.
I don't know a great deal about them. It's just sort of recent. Introduced them from friends, but being a pot skirt, it's a metal collar that goes around your pot. And after the flame is reduced, the radiant heat isn't allowed to escape and can continue to finish the cook, so you can shorten the time you have it on your burner or such.
Yeah, that sounds like a good system. I mean, that would be a good solution if you're burning gas and, you know, to help reduce that greenhouse. Certainly I encourage you to move on to this electric solution, so we can take advantage of the, you know, wind and solar, the renewable tariffs when they get it there. And, you know, just very efficient. What I actually have, I do have a gas range in my house, but I don't use it. I bought a portable induction unit that I actually sit on top of my stove. So I actually do most of my cooking with that.
I do think there's some small personal things that can be done around that by, from what you're talking about in the home, but just reduce. Mm-hmm. Your thermostat level and put more clothes on, maybe a thermal base layer, circulating fans, moving the air around, actually reduce your cooling costs as well. It's some of the dramatic things I've heard from some people doing that actually tying their sink drain to fill their toilet tank. So do you utilize that gray water twice before flushing and reducing their water use in the home?
I haven't myself. I have reinstalled what they call dual flush toilets. So, you know, it's a smaller water usage on fluid. So there's actually two buttons on the toilet to do a large flush or a small flush. Ken, why don't you jump in here?
One thing I'd...
Go ahead, Philip.
I'll pass it off to Ken because he's also very well-versed on energy efficiency. But just wanted to note really quickly that we're going to have a pay-as-you-save pays program that Evergy is going to be offering sometime next year that will finance a lot of energy efficiency upgrades for residential customers, and it'll all be on their utility bill. So if anyone's listening and you know you're getting really excited hearing about all these great efficiency options, I would keep a lookout for that because that'll be a great way to get it cost effectively and save you some money. And Ken is a very knowledgeable on all things energy efficiency as well.
Thank you. I would like to point out too that Independence, Missouri has programs as well. And so it's there's options out there no matter who you get your power from. And what did you want me to talk about? These guys are doing a great job covering the subjects, I think, so far.
Just give me a chance to jump in here. I mean, this is a broad subject. I know IPL, Independence Power and Light, they've been providing solar for several years now, haven't they?
Yeah. They have a solar farm that they own, and they've had rebates for electric equipment like electric water heaters and heat pumps, things like that. They've had those for a long time, since around 1990.
So both IPL and Evergy are both providing incentives to move to these electric power solutions in your home.
Right. I'm familiar with that program as well as KCBPU or Kansas City Board of Public Utilities on the Kansas City, Kansas side has rebate programs too. So putting in more efficient equipment.
Now, does anybody see any disadvantages to moving to electricity in your home at this point?
Well, at the moment, if we have a lot of coal-fired generation, you're kind of just trading one pollutant for another. Philip's shaking his head on that one. As we move toward more of a mix, add more solar or wind to what they call a generation mix, then that will pay better as far as efficiency goes. The pollution will go down. So we're really trying to get people either to install solar on their homes. As the group I represent, which is the Heartland Renewable Energy Society, we're trying to encourage folks to install solar. And of course, that can be done several ways. And Philip probably has all the program information much better than I do. But bottom line, you can lease a solar system, which means you have basically no upfront cost. Downside of that is a couple, you don't get any your tax deductions and all. I don't think there's much for you when you lease. I think that all goes to the leasing people.
So if and you buy, there's tax deductions.
Right. There's also, we're not taking advantage of it. And I don't know where any of that stands now because it's kind of been bounced around. But there's what's called green credits and white credits, green for renewable energy and white for energy efficiency. And those other countries take advantage of them and trade carbon credits. But we don't do any of that yet. But if you own a solar system and that comes into account, then you can take advantage of it. If you don't own it, obviously you can.
So I did want to get into rooftop solar. You see that as a viable system today, and you're mentioning the credits you can get if you purchase, or you could just lease a system with no upfront cost. What are the advantages of that?
Well, I think there's a misconception, and I hate to because talking about solar, I'm an advocate for it. And Stan hasn't had a chance to talk, but he's been a big advocate for it forever too. And most people understand if you work with it at all, the benefits of it. But if you install solar, as most people do now, they grid connect it, which means they connect directly to the electric utility and they don't have any backup system like a battery, well, typically a battery. And so if you don't have a backup system, when the grid goes down, you have no power just like everybody else. And sometimes people put in solar thinking that, well, good, when the power's out, I have a backup. Well, unless you specifically put in a battery or put in a backup system, you do not. So they're shocked when the power goes out and they're out just like their neighbors.
If the power goes down and the sun's shining on my cells, won't that generate electricity within my home?
Yes, but if your home is not wired to do that, if you're wired tied directly to the grid, and what you're doing is trading power back and forth with the utility, and you don't have a way to divert that power to your house.
So you'd have to have a diverter or a breaker at the box someplace
where you can turn the grid. That has to be designed into it in mind as you put the system in.
Right. So what happens? So, I mean, we obviously there's financial incentives to putting solar on our roof now, and that moves us away from the fossil fuels and gets us into electricity today. What happens when the utilities start providing renewable energy? Does that negate our solar rooftop, or will the rooftop solar work in collaboration with the public utility renewables? Anybody wants to comment on that?
I'll grab that one first, just real quick. Utilities are used to being with centralized power systems. And so they can turn things on and off in one spot and control what's happening on the grid. And that's been historically the way it's been. Nothing terribly wrong with that, because for the longest time, that was the system we had. But as people put in their own solar systems, and they're starting to put in what's called distributed energy or distributed power, meaning instead of one power source in one location, you have all these little power sources all over the place. And the utilities have a little bit of a problem with that, in that it's hard for them to track. Well, let me say it this way. When you put in a solar system, you put in an inverter, which converts your power from DC direct current to AC or alternating current. And those, they convert when the grid goes down and they shut down, they do not backfeed into the grid to shock somebody, because a lineman has no idea if the power's out from the utility side, from the generating station, that somebody nearby is also contributing to the grid with their solar system. So the safety factor is built in. And bottom line is that when the grid goes down, your solar goes down unless you have another way to provide power to yourself. And I'm going to stop on that, because I made that point, and let Philip or someone else jump in now.
Well, I would just add for future evaluation, like, we're going to find out what that's going to look like. So in places like California, Arizona, or Hawaii, where you have a larger penetration of distributed solar, that's what they're asking themselves right now. That's what utility commissions are looking at. That's what experts are looking at in those places, or what are we going to do about this? So we're already starting to ask those questions in Missouri. As of last week, the Missouri Public Service Commission is looking at starting a value of solar study process. So we're looking at evaluating the value of solar at specific times, how that impacts with their generation, because for Evergy, for instance, they have their sustainability transformation plan that was announced. They're going to be looking at maybe supporting the securitization policy that NRDC has been advocating for over the last few years. And that would allow them to securitize and close fossil fuel plants earlier than expected, and then charge that to ratepayers and replace that generation with renewables. And then if you get into this issue of, we have too much solar on the grid, like, you know, 30% above 30% of your customers all have solar and they're generating, then you get into peak conversations of, where are the customers peaking their generation versus the utilities peak of where they need to generate power for the day. So one thing that value of solar and other things have looked at are, what if we change the orientation of your solar system to, say, be southwest, so it matches up closer with the peak of the utility, so they get more benefit and the solar customer still gets a benefit for it. And Columbia Water and Light in Columbia, Missouri has been proactive on this, and they're tying their rebate for solar customers to be at a higher incentive if it's an orientation that is matching with their peak as a utility. So if we think of it in those kind of ways and start getting out a little further ahead before we have those problems, we can fix it and just let everybody keep generating as much as they want, and we'll have it figured out on the policy side ahead of time.
Stan.
One resource I'd mention is the Rocky Mountain Institute, and it's rmi.org. And they are way out overhead, over their skis, and not in a bad way, but they're talking about the energy transition, electrification, very high level partnerships they're making. They are a tremendous resource for this kind of information. So just sign up for their newsletter and watch what they're bringing forward. But it's very encouraging. And I believe that that kind of utility assistance planning is what we're headed for. And they seem to be leading it in my estimation.
And for you guys that are involved in it a little more, what I guess my question being, how much does our builders of houses and stuff need to get involved in the way we are constructing homes and such with, you know, using possible passive solar or more geo earth-based type systems, or do we need drastic changes?
I see a lot of heads nodding.
My problem with building is that it's a real estate driven industry. It's developers and realtors, and they want to keep it alive for the next subdivision. If this is seriously my opinion, and I'm kind of skewed, I live in Lee Summit, which is controlled by realtors and developers, and it's a problem that keeps out innovative codes, new kinds of ideas, and I don't know how to unentrench that system. But we're having an addition put onto our house. The builder did a great job, but could have done more and wanted to. Couldn't get it through codes.
Let's move on to our next topic. I mean, there's so much we can talk in renewable energy, and since it is 41% of our greenhouse gas emissions, it's very important, but I do want to hit the other sectors. I might mention that our next climate hour next month will be taking a deep dive into sustainable energy. So the things that we've just kind of hit the top on now, we're going to spend an hour talking about those next month. So hopefully a lot of you can join us again, and we'll have some other speakers here. Let's move on to the agricultural and forestry sector. This is a lot about how we raise our food, what we eat, how we eat, and it's surprisingly significant. We're looking at a 24% impact, and I want to look at by the University of Oxford recently. They looked at 40,000 farms worldwide. That was in 119 countries, 40 food products that were basically 90% of everything that we ate. And they measured the amount of greenhouse gases, kilograms, that would be produced to produce 100 grams of product. And they have this wonderful chart that ranks the foods in, and beef is at the top, down to peas at the bottom, so legumes. What this chart shows us, and I wish everybody could see this, this was published in the in Science, which is the Journal of the American Association for the Advancement of Science. If you have access to that or Google that on the website, find this chart. It's very interesting. Basically, what I'm seeing when I look at this chart is that beef, and that's herd beef, CAFOs and such, they produce up to 105 kilograms of greenhouse gases per 100 grams of meat. And the next one down there, and there's this dramatic drop to everything else on the list, other meats like dairy, lamb and mutton, poultry, pig, these are dropping down much smaller, basically, you know, maybe a fifth of the greenhouse gases produced by the beef industry. And then when you start looking at your non-meat products, your tofu, nuts, eggs, pulses, peas, they're pretty insignificant. For instance, tofu, it produces less than 3.5 kilograms of greenhouse gas for that same 100 grams of protein. So we're seeing a chart here that shows that beef is kind of unique in being an extremely high producer of greenhouse gas. Other meats, much better than beef. And then obviously your vegetables, much, much lower than that. And here's another chart that I wanted to share that was published in the Journal of Proceedings of the Natural Academy of Sciences. And this is just looking at different diets over the next 30 years. A healthy global diet. This is a diet that's recommended by doctors. You know, we continue to eat meat, be omnivores, but, you know, we reduce our portions. You know, every time you go into the doctor, they'll say, well, you know, eat smaller portions of meat, eat your vegetables, eat your fruit, eat a balanced diet. If we all just move to that instead of this meat-heavy American diet we have, we would actually save 3.5 gigatons of carbon equivalent over the next 30 years. So that's just moving to a healthy meat-based diet. if we move to vegetarian, and that's still eating eggs and dairy, but eliminating the meats, we'd be able to save almost 7.5 gigatons of greenhouse gases. And then becoming vegan, which is kind of the gold standard, would actually be 8.5 gigatons of greenhouse gases. So we can see how our personal food choices, what we eat, the types of food we get, where we get those foods can have a huge impact on our personal carbon footprint. So why don't we start with Mark? I know you're with Cultivate KC. You supervise farms and growing here locally. What's your opinion on this, and what kind of resources do we have available to us as individuals?
So I'm mostly a fruit and vegetable grower. I do work with some meat growers here and there. It'd be interesting to see on some of the back data of those studies on beef, how much they're accounting in the growing of the feed is why that cattle number is so high. Just right off the bat, the distance our food travels is a great effect in those greenhouses. So the more we are supporting local farms or growing our own food, reducing that carbon emission just from the travel. There's supporting farms that have regenerative practices, such as no-till or minimal tillage. So much of the carbon that exists in agricultural systems is lost through the soil. When we till, the microbes that have stored carbon in the soil by transferring from the plants to the roots is then released back into the atmosphere. That's a large part of ag emissions. And I'm sure Stan can go well into the benefits of the waste of food and when the need for composting on personal scale, on city scale. I don't know where else you want the conversation to go. There's so many aspects to agriculture to talk about.
I think beef, and you mentioned beef, you had that question there. The backside of the study is it does include the entire carbon footprint. So it's looking at the feed. The high end of the beef is obviously coming from the CAFOs, you know, the commercial animal farming operations. You know, when we start looking at free range and managed grazing and silvopasture, those kind of things can produce good meat product with much, much lower greenhouse gas emissions.
Well, if we look into the feed just aspects, what you can correct me if I'm wrong, but I'm pretty sure it runs into 11-to-1 ratio. It takes 11 pounds of grain to produce 1 pound of beef. So that ratio is off. And we look at how many, you know, millions of acres of grain feed that we're growing out there to feed than a CAFO operation. Just transferring to grass-fed beef or open pasture, it would greatly reduce that. And a lot of that is, I think, being proven by many farmers that it can be done well. For people to look up, guys like Joel Salatin. Stan, I'm drawing is the fellow Gale in Kansas.
Gale Fuller.
Gale Fuller. I was missing his last name. Great grass-fed beef rancher transitioning out of your traditional systems.
Yeah, I don't think, we're not here advocating everybody becoming vegan, but you know, if you reduce the amount of meat, if you're careful with where you source it, for instance, that study, if we just look at the numbers, this was actually a different study done by the University of California at Davis. They looked at the amount of carbon produced per serving of food products. And they found that a serving of beef produced 330 grams of carbon, a serving of chicken, same size, just produces 52 grams of carbon. Serving of fish, same size, 40 grams. But then if we go to vegetables, you know, for the same amount of protein and calories, if a serving of vegetables only produces 14 grams of carbon, and a serving of lentils, which is a complete protein, it gives you all the amino acids that beef does. So a serving of lentils just produces 2 grams. So we can see how our food choices make a big difference. And that doesn't mean you have to give up beef. But if we would all save beef for special occasions and go heavier towards some of these other meat-based or vegetable-based products, we can have a dramatic impact on our carbon footprints. And it's interesting, I think most of us are familiar with the Drawdown Project these days that looked at all the solutions for reducing greenhouse gases. It's interesting that food and food waste is number 3 and number 4 on their list. I should have said earlier, we were talking about renewable energy. Wind and solar is actually number 1 and 2. So we're basically just working our way down the drawdown solutions list. But Stan, why don't you talk about food waste? That has a huge impact on greenhouse gas emissions.
Well, we're really excited to be involved in that at Missouri Organic. And our audience might be interested to know that we've received a grant from the Kansas Department of Health and Environment to take food waste and composting education to 50 schools statewide. And this poster over this shoulder is the Food Too Good to Waste ideal village where everybody's doing everything right. But the website is foodtogoodtowaste.com. And Missouri Organic is now holding 400 tons a week of food waste that we're collecting from all over the area. And been finding, we take our food waste, we grind it, and the plastic and cardboard packaging gets rejected in a machine called a depackager. We take that cardboard and plastic and put it in with wood chips and send it to a cement kiln. So that's zero waste to landfill. And that's a very high premium for these corporations that want to send their waste to the greenest possible disposal option. So they get credits in terms of ratings as far as their footprint to do this. So we're really having a huge influx of food waste from grocery stores. We have Kroger and Dillon's that have come on recently, and we had to turn down 15 semi-trailer loads because we couldn't handle it. And so it's a growth industry, and it actually makes tremendous compost. This food waste comes out of the depackager and gets pumped into a 30-some yard mixer and mixed with ground up leaves. And it's a system that's unique in the United States, that a liquid nitrogen product, you know, think about dropping a whole squash into a compost pile, how long will it be before all of those molecules are available? Well, if it's a ground liquid of food waste slurry mixed completely with small particles of brown stuff, that compost is ready to rock almost immediately. And it has really short processing times and works really, really well. So we're proud of that situation that's going forward. And we're not sure how fast we can grow in terms of making that happen. But with COVID, the compost sales, everybody wanted to get back to the land. They want healthier food. They want to spend more time in their backyard. I don't know. We all know some element of this COVID expansion where there's some contractions, but there have been some serious expansions. And buying compost and mulch has been one of them. And that's a great, great trend. I wanted to also mention, we do work with a lot of vegetable growers and provide the compost and organic products, mulches. But I'm a devotee of Acres Magazine, which is a real powerful resource for regenerative ag. Their conferences have gone from 50 people, you know, meeting in a closet, and all of a sudden it's 1,200 people from all over the world meeting, and this year virtually, I'm not sure how many they'll have, but it's a huge movement, and there's a lot going on with that. I'd also like to piggyback on what Mark said, in that some of these grass-fed beef people don't need a tractor. They're so low impact in the production, and you're getting better HDL cholesterol, better balance of the amino fatty acids, healthier food, and the ground needs grazing. The herds need to fertilize and do their work. They stretch grass, cut the tops back, and let the roots rot. That's how we built the soil in Iowa 15,000 years ago. Iowa was a glacially scraped rock, and all that soil came from buffalo and prairie grass. So this is something we've got to be aware of. The other thing is, conventional agriculture is bankrupt. If it weren't for insurance and subsidies, nobody makes any money. And frankly, nobody's making any money now except the people providing the inputs. So farmers want off. They're increasingly elderly and increasingly sick from the work that they're doing. So we're about to see a sea change, in my opinion, towards regenerative ag and regenerative animal production.
No, we're seeing some shifts in even where there's a call for farmers to be part of an environmental services, perhaps like an example being New York City is paying farmers upstream of them to change their practice so that they don't have to spend as much money cleaning their water supply at when it gets down. And we possibly will see that expand into more and more areas as well.
It's interesting. I'm looking at a website called refed.com, which is all about food waste. You're familiar with that one, Stan?
Great resource.
Yeah, it's saying that food waste consumes 21% of our fresh water, 19% of all fertilizer, 18% of our crop land, and 20% of our landfill. So that's pretty significant. And kind of like Drawdown, they give a list of 27 solutions on how we can reduce our food waste. So, you know, things that we can act on as individuals, as communities. So that's a great resource to check out if you're interested in that.
Backyard composting is a radical act. And I just yesterday cleaned the top off my pile and harvested 4 wheelbarrow loads of black gold that I've dumped on my garden for next year. Now's a good time. And, you know, Missouri Organic doesn't make compost that is as alive as that compost in your backyard. And it's not that hard.
Seems like there's several layers. I know, Stan, your group is pulling compost from large complexes, apartments and such like that. There's also some middle scale curbside composting groups. Can you tell us a little bit about those?
Absolutely. We have a terrific exemplary organization in Kansas City area called Compost Collective. And they're the 5-gallon bucket door-to-door service. And you can get it at almost any frequency you need. They're only about 3 years old and they've expanded throughout the central part of Kansas City and are now opening in Lawrence. So we're glad because they aggregate food waste for us and we end up getting that food waste to process. And it's also, their stuff can go straight in the pile. It's extremely clean. Homeowners separate much better than the guy in the back of the restaurant.
So they're actually picking them up from the homes and taking them to your group, Missouri Organic Recycling.
Well, they were thinking of ways they could compost it locally, but all of a sudden they're getting into good sized numbers with what they're collecting.
I know they're a member of the Climate Council, and there's also KC Can Compost.
Right. I'm not as familiar with their program, but I understand that they're doing things with underemployed people to help them get involved and collecting from, I'm not sure. Here's Barbara, were you waiting?
No. There's also just sometimes the farms near that you live nearby will allow you to bring their compost to them. I know Herbivore there down near Swope Park allows their community neighbors to bring the compost to there and they'll compost for them. There's chances to just work with some of your local farms. If you don't compost in your backyard, you know, there might be one that take it or even taking your bags of leaves and such.
Well, Hennepin County, Minneapolis is the poster child for how to develop a regional composting system. They started putting food waste containers at farmers markets and then rolled that out to drop offs throughout the city. And then 2 years ago, mandated curbside food waste collection. You had to opt in to get the container, but everybody paid for it. And so they're having very low contamination rates. People are educated about it. And they built that over a 5-year period with real consistent focus. And that we can do that. We've never had that consistent focus in our public education outreach, but it's very possible. And we have much of that system in place, but not as well organized.
And you mentioned farmers markets. I think one of the best things we can do as individuals is shop our local farmers markets. You know, not only supporting our local small farmers, but you know, we're not transporting the products. So, you know, it lowers our greenhouse gas emissions, getting better quality food. And you know, it's a way that we can make a difference individually. So, you know, shopping small, shopping, I was going to say, even to the vegans, you can lower your carbon footprint by eating whole food, plant-based, moving away from the manufactured packaged products. So the farmer's market is a big thing for the vegans.
There is an organization in Kansas City called After the Harvest, which, so if you are growing plots of food at your house or a larger farm, that they will come and glean the field. And then before it goes into compost, they'll perhaps disperse it to a food bank. So just that first step on eliminating food waste, seeing if food could be used and then what can't be, then move into a composting system.
Ken?
Yeah, I'm gonna shift gears for a minute, if that's okay. When I was talking earlier about the solar systems and that you, if you have a battery backup, then you're gonna have power when there's no one else having power because you have stored power. The transportation sector, which I don't know how much time we'll touch on that, but when it gets to the point where we have AI or artificial intelligence to a point where you have a smart home and an electric vehicle, one of the early visions in the Rocky Mountain Institute, Amory Lovins, which was brought up earlier, many years ago, he brought this up, that with two things, that cars could be made out of technologies that are, you know, nanotechnology, so we don't have to spend so much energy on steel or whatever. But the other thing he came up with is that a car, a electric vehicle, is a battery. And so if you are smart enough, your house is smart enough, and your vehicle is smart enough, you drive around during the day, most of the time you probably won't use but a partial battery, maybe half or a third. You come home, park the car for the night. Well, if your car could provide power on the battery for the 2 or 3 hours, 4 hours at night that you need power, it would then keep you off the grid. And of course, if power goes down, you could even make it really smart where it only provides power to your refrigeration and emergency lights and stuff. So it could actually last for days if potentially. But bottom line, what I'm saying is, if you could shift the battery in your car to being also a house storage battery to give you power for 2 or 3 or 4 hours a night while you're home watching TV and all that, when you go to bed, it would switch back to charging. And at night, that's the best time to charge the car anyway, at 11 to 12 o'clock at night till 5 in the morning, because people are using power. Then the utilities, most of them have what's called wheeling power. The power plants are still spinning, but nobody's using the energy, but they can't turn them off because they have to have them back on the next day. If you could start using that power, it'd be ideal. Now we're doing what's called load leveling. But so what I didn't want to make it sound like buying a solar system or leasing one was a dead end. If they get to the point where you can use your electric car as your backup source, it's kind of going to be an ideal situation. So I think we're working our way to that very soon.
And I think that's a perfect transition into the transportation sector, which is responsible for 14% of our greenhouse gas emissions. Individually, what we can do personally to reduce our carbon footprint is put an emphasis on active transportation. And by that, we're talking about walking and biking. And there's a lot of health and economic benefits. We won't talk much on that today. I think we want to address mass transit and electric cars, because that's the expertise we have here today. I think in terms of electric cars, just jumping in there and throwing out some stats, if you're powering your electric car with electricity that's coming from a fossil fuel plant, you're still using 50% or generating 50% less greenhouse gas emissions than driving a gas car. And that's plugging your car into a coal or gas powered power plant. If you're plugging your electric car into a grid that's renewable energy, you're actually reducing greenhouse gas emissions by 99%. That's incredibly, you know, that's an incredible amount. So, you know, moving to an EV is a huge step you can make. Other advantages of an EV is that there's less maintenance involved. Think about that electric car. It's basically a battery and electric motor. There's no muffler, no engine starter, no oil pumps, spark plugs, gaskets, fan belts, filters, you know, all that stuff that we're constantly taking our car in to get fixed. There's none of that on an EV. You're basically going to have some simple annual maintenance, tune the electronics. So the average cost of running an EV is significantly lower than a gas-powered. University of Michigan did a study in 2018, and they looked at cars all across the nation, so they developed an average. And they found that the average fossil fuel gas-powered car goes 22 miles on a dollar. The national average for an electric vehicle was 36 miles for a dollar. So what is that? That's well, 50, 60% more mileage on that EV for the same amount of money. And the cost to operate, they found that nationwide, the average gas car costs us $1,117 a year to maintain. The average EV costs $485. So less than half on the EV. So they're certainly well worth investing in. The Union of Concerned Scientists did a study, and they looked at the overall lifetime of an EV versus a gas car. And this is manufacturing the car and battery, running it and the fuel, and then disposing of it at the end of that car's life cycle. They found that the average gas vehicle emits 57 metric tons of greenhouse gases over its lifetime. The average electric vehicle emits 28 metric tons of greenhouse gases over its lifetime. And that's plugging your EV into a fossil fueled power grid. So that's pretty significant. So let's talk a little bit about electric cars, electric transportation, mass transit. Philip, you want to take a shot at that?
Yeah, sure. So there are currently two electrification dockets in Missouri. One for Evergy, one for Ameren, looking at increased electrification for the state. We're also seeing an extended rollout of the Volkswagen settlement process that happened throughout most of the country. But when for those who weren't around or participating in climate action back then, just to refresh, Volkswagen had falsified emissions from some vehicles. And due to that, it was found that they led to huge emissions throughout the country that were not anticipated. So because of that, they had to pay out a huge settlement to the U.S. government. As part of that, states are then getting money back to them based on how many cars were purchased in their state. So Missouri is getting, it's going to go towards a EV infrastructure network throughout the state. And that'll help a lot of our rural areas that have not gone out and invested in EV chargers. Thankfully, we have the most per capita in terms of EV chargers here in Kansas City because of the work that Evergy decided to do ahead of the commission. So if we keep seeing this infrastructure built, you know, if we build it, they will come. We need folks to not have range anxiety from getting point A to B throughout the state. So the more chargers we get, more rebates and other incentives we get for people to own cars, the better. And also to tie back to points of renewable energy, the more generation we have on the grid, the more generation we have locally, will also help people feel like they're doing the most. Because if you can get clean power into your clean vehicle, then you're really, you know, double dipping to reduce your emissions.
That's really great. Stan.
There's a lot going on in fleet trucks. Volvo was working with the Port of Los Angeles to do a lot. Battery design is coming on fast. They're talking about trucks in 2024 with 1,000 horsepower and three engines that'll do 0 to 60 in 3 seconds and have a 500-mile range. Sell that truck if we can go that fast and tow that much. And high capacity ones look good.
I saw a study recently, and this is a group that's providing commercial passenger buses, but they've now got a prototype electric bus that can do over 1,000 miles on a single charge. So, you know, we're starting to look at the potential of getting on a bus and reaching either coast from Kansas City on a single charge. So I think we're at a breaking point. I mean, we're going to see such radical changes in the upcoming months, years, that EVs are the cost-effective solution.
If we could have a buyback, an incentive program for recycling our cars to EVs, I think we, at the federal level, for example, we could really accelerate this trend and cut our emissions a great deal. I think there's, I got a ride in a Tesla, a dual engine Tesla I have never been pinned in a cage like I was in a dual engine Tesla. You know, it was just unbelievable and quiet, powerful.
Let's move on to the industrial sector. We got about 10 minutes left, and this is responsible for 41% of our greenhouse gas emissions, the industrial sector. And I want to focus specifically on sustainable fashion. Why fashion? Surprisingly, the fashion industry is the largest industrial greenhouse gas emitter of all industries. They represent 38.6% of all industrial greenhouse gas emissions. You think in all industries in the world, 38.6% of those emissions are coming from one sector, and that's the fashion industry. So fashion industry represents over 8% of all greenhouse gas emissions. And a lot of those, we measure that in terms of energy use. You know, fashion industry, they're looking at the amount of energy it takes to produce something. I saw a recent study. Do I have a slide on this? I don't. So let me just share with you. It takes 15 kilojoules to produce a pound of glass, and that's the glass in our windows. It takes 36 kilojoules of electricity to produce a pound of steel, and you know, steel, buildings, all of that. You know, it takes 123 kilojoules to produce 1 pound of polyester. Stop and think about that. We can produce glass and steel for a fraction of the energy and greenhouse gas emissions that it takes to produce polyester. And it goes up from there. Acrylic takes 170 kilojoules to produce a pound. Nylon takes 250 kilojoules of energy to produce a pound of fabric. So our fabric choices have an incredible impact. And, you know, we probably won't have time, but, you know, we also need to touch on microfibers, and the fashion industry dyes and tanning and chemicals is the largest water polluter, and the waste and landfill, and the human rights. So if you look at third world countries and workforce, fashion industry is responsible for a lot of human rights issues. So Eileen, let's jump with you. You're the sewing lab. I mean, you work with fast fashion. You have solutions of how we as individuals can move to more sustainable fashion.
Absolutely. So the Sewing Labs teaches the legacy of sewing for employment, entrepreneurship, and enrichment. We're huge proponents of slow fashion, upcycling, recycling, repurposing. Fashion, from what I've read, is the number two polluter in the world. You think about what it's done in terms of, think about those $5 t-shirts that are sold all over the place and some of those big box stores and what goes into creating those $5 t-shirts and how long they last, which is not very long. And then they end up being pitched or thrown into a landfill, which is just terrifying to think about how much of our waste goes into that. Part of it has to do with consumerism and reducing consumerism. I think that's critical for us. You know, it's grown tremendously over the years. Fast fashion has become the, you know, most prevalent part of consumerism. There's a hunger to have the latest trends. And we prefer people to have more of a hunger for things like mindful mending and upcycling and repurposing. It's estimated that there's 20 new garments manufactured per person each year. And we're buying 60% more garments than we were in the year 2000. And each garment is worn less and less. And so it has a shorter lifespan. And those recycling options, there's not very many of them, but you can recycle fabric. I have an example of some paper. This paper was made out of upcycled military uniforms. And there's a nonprofit around who's making this paper and they're using it to write letters to the military with, which we think is really awesome. 60% of textiles used in clothing and a large proportion of clothing manufacturing occurs overseas in countries that rely on coal-fueled power plants. And that's increasing the footprint with each garment. So It's about individual actions that consumers can take, and businesses can send strong messages and spark that change. So again, it's all about, you know, revisiting the old clothes in your wardrobe. Is there anything in there that you can breathe new life into? You know, get a seam ripper and deconstruct an outfit and learn how it was put together. Learn how clothes are made. You know, with COVID, fabric masks has and people digging out high school sewing machines that they got as a graduation gift has become kind of a trend. So there's a renewed interest in sewing, and I think giving people opportunities to reduce their own personal footprint. You know, here at the Sewing Labs, we do several workshops. We've done, if we haven't done it, we're going to. We had to put a hold on some of them because of COVID, but we were going to do a workshop in March when we actually had to close our doors on paper towels. So making fabric that you can use to clean up with and throw them in the washer when you're done, or doing mindful mending workshops. We've done a shibori dyeing workshops recently. We've done boro stitching workshops. You could make unsponges or reusable produce bags, reusable grocery totes. We've actually done workshops here where we give back to the community. We did one on feminine care products that are reusable, and those were donated to the homeless community. There's all kinds of wonderful ideas. And I have some of my favorite, I have one of my favorite books with me today. It's called The Conscious Closet, which is a great read. A couple other of my favorite books that I recommend to people. There's one called Fashionopolis by Dana Thomas. Mending Matters by Katrina Rodebau. I'm really taking a mindful approach to mending clothes. I know there's kind of a trend with the ripped blue jeans, but you can make those really artful and awesome by mindfully mending them. Another great book I came across just this past weekend is called Joyful Mending by Noriki Misumi. You know, all it really takes is a needle and a thread and a scissors, and you can make some amazing changes.
Sounds like there's a lot of things we can do. I mean, and we're all concerned with fashion. So, you know, buying our clothes used, shopping your closet, the fabric you choose is significant. And I think we could all make a pledge just to get the fossil fuels out of our fabric. You know, the polyesters, the nylons, the acrylics, those are incredibly bad for the environment, not only in terms of greenhouse gases, but the microplastics. I think I read some study that they found that 700,000 microfibers come out of a single standard home washing of polyester fabric. That's a huge number. And talking about the ocean, I can't even conceive that. It was like 1.4 quadrillion. That was like a number with 50 zeros after it. That's how much microplastic. So that's an issue. But if you just look in terms of fabric, if you're going to buy clothes that are sustainable, not clothes that you're going to throw away in a week. Buy clothes that are kind of universal, you know, things that you can accessorize to get different feels out of, but clothing that you can wear for a decade, not clothing you're going to wear twice and put in a landfill. And the fabrics, I'm looking at a study from the Stockholm Environmental Institute. You know, we were talking about kilojoules earlier, you know, steel was like 36, you know, linen, it just takes 10 kilojoules to produce that unit of linen. And hemp is even better. So there's a lot of hemp and linen clothing out there that tends to be products that are going to last longer, they're quality made, and have a much smaller footprint. Other things that are listed is cotton. Organic cotton has a much, much smaller footprint because you're not spending as much time putting herbicides and pesticides and watering. There's less mechanics involved in producing organic cotton. So that's also a good solution. And then in the middle range of greenhouse gas emissions, we've got the non-organic cotton. We've got the wool, rPET, which is converting plastic to fabrics. Those are higher. Viscose is even higher in terms of its greenhouse gas emission. And viscose, we're talking about bamboo. You're starting to see bamboo clothing. And I'm a huge proponent of bamboo. I think that's a great product, but it does have a higher emission right now. So, you know, I really encourage people to look at the hemp, the linen, the used, the secondhand stores. There's a lot of ways that we can all be fashionable and still lower our carbon footprint. So I think we're running out of time. I want to close right now. You know, a lot of the information that we've been sharing is available in the education section of the Climate Council's website. So you can find the Climate Council at www.climategkc.org. Philip, where would a person go to learn more about Renew Missouri?
So the best place to go would be renewmo.org. We are also on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram. We have an extensive email list, and we're always giving updates. So if you want to hear from us, please go to renewmo.org and sign up to hear from us. Thanks.
Thanks, Philip. Ken Reed, Heartland Renewable Energy Society. Where do we go to learn about them?
That would be at heartlandrenewable.org. And I would point out that I'm wearing a shirt from the secondhand store right now. So
very good.
One of the better shirts I own, actually.
Mark, tell us about Cultivate KC. Where can we go and learn more about
Cultivate, that? CultivateKC.org. You can also find us at Cultivate KC on Facebook and Twitter as well.
Very good. And Eileen, the Sewing
Absolutely.
Lab.
Absolutely. The Sewing Labs, plural, .community is our website, and we're on Facebook and Instagram as well. We post a lot of our workshops on Facebook.
Well, thank you. Thank you for joining us today, and thank you to our speakers. Please join us again next month when the Climate Hour is going to take a deep dive into sustainable energy. You know, we're going to explore the environmental and economic impacts of everything we plug in. You know, we covered a lot of that today, but you know, as we saw, there's a lot more to go. So please join us again next month. I'm your host, Bob Grove.